You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, we put our green thumbs to work developing a community garden. And we'll find out about a national scheme where kids are teaching other kids about where their food comes from. We go diving for seaweed in freezing cold Tasmanian waters and meet two legends of the American rodeo circuit out in Australia passing on their skills. Bullfighter Rob Smets takes his job very seriously.
It's a lot like being the bodyguard for our president, the Secret Service guys. I fought bulls for 30 years. I survived three broken necks, one goring and one broken leg over a 30-year career. It's a badge of honor to us. You know, if somebody's going to get hurt, not on my watch.
School's in for bull riders and bull fighters later in the show. But what better way to start the day than with a spot of gardening in far north Queensland?
Community gardens are really about gardening together. A lot of the people that are here are actually really good gardeners. Some people are coming along to learn, but more than anything else, the sense is of working together. And people again and again are saying, you know, why do you garden on your own when you can be doing it together and eating together and having that beautiful communal feeling?
It's a glorious Saturday morning in Queensland's highest town, and a small group of volunteers is here hard at work. They're in the process of transforming the site of a derelict basketball court into a beautiful, functional, edible garden. Hello, I'm Charlie McKillop at Ravenshoe, about 2 hours' drive southwest of Cairns in far north Queensland. This project is the brainchild of Julianne Hartman, but everyone just calls her Jules.
Well, I think putting your hands in the dirt connects you with the earth, and that's, you know, that's really where we're from, so that's a basic thing. But it's more the sense of working together. We don't get to do much of that anymore on a volunteer basis. You know, we're stuck in front of the telly a lot of the time, and we're losing our sense of connectedness. And there's something as basic as putting your hands in the dirt and growing food. That's really, really simple. And then doing that with other people, it starts to reforge connections that societies we're losing to a certain extent, I think.
If you are a good gardener, what have you got to learn from being involved in a community garden like this project?
There's a few things. The gardens are completely organic, so you'll learn organic gardening at the very basic, and then we'll sort of move into permaculture design. So as we build garden beds, we do a little design session. Today, we're not going to have time to do it, but we're going to put in a green manure crop, for example. And a lot of people read these things but don't really get the full sense of it once you've actually done it. So many people learn by doing. We've got a lovely lady who's going to keep a diary for us, so we'll have a record of what's growing well and what the seasons are doing, so we'll be able to actually create a specific Ravenshoe planting guide. So that's going to be really useful for the new settlers. We're getting a lot of new settlers in Ravenshoe. It's an evolving design because it's the people's garden. It's nobody's personal design. It's just the only, it's not even a rule, but the only guideline that we have is that it's food plants. And that includes pansies because they're edible flowers, delicious little, so we'll have edible flowers to beautify it as well. And
but no growing things just to look pretty?
No, the azaleas are out the window. So
now how are the workers going here?
We're just sieving the grass and the weeds out of the soil so we can build beds out of it. And we're adding Min Plus and chook manure and that to the wheelbarrows as we go, and then we're wheelbarrowing it to the areas where it's needed.
All this mound of soil used to be what covered this whole area here and was the basketball courts, was that right? Yeah, so it's just all been, that was our very first job, having a big digger in here and shoveling all the soil off the court. And that's it there in a big pile. And that's many years of weeds and stuff that we're sifting through now and making it into usable soil. So, yeah, it's going really well.
Sounds like hard yakka, Glenda.
It is hard yakka. But it's good. It's good fun and great community spirit. And now we're getting the job done. I'm very impressed with what we've achieved in the last month.
When do you start reaping the rewards of your labour?
We already have. We had picked a salad, a big bowl of salad. And we had some salad dressing, and so I made some tabbouleh. We made tomatoes, sliced up tomatoes. and we all had a lovely early lunch, and it was wonderful. So we are enjoying it already.
What is it about food that you grow yourself that tastes so good?
It's more appreciated because you've grown it yourself. It's just, and you know that there aren't any sprays, and it's all organic, and it's healthy, and it's just gives a wonderful feeling of accomplishment to be able to eat something from your own garden.
And fresh is best.
Yes, fresh is best.
I tell you what, you fellas look like you almost know what you're doing.
Yeah, we've done a bit kind of this sort of thing. Here and there and all over Australia.
How would you describe your role in this? Are you the brawn behind the beauty?
We do all the grunty work, a lot of it. Moving the rocks, putting the posts in, that sort of thing. But the girls do all the delicate stuff. Very handy.
It's more with the initial setting up of a garden, there's various infrastructure to put in place and that's more our role, and then we'll have the pleasure of gardening as well.
What do you get out of this, Max?
I'm a visitor up from Charles Towers, house sitting up here at the moment, and I run across his ad in the local paper, and of course I'm coming along for the next two or three Saturdays, and I just love supporting the ladies that and the concept of the community garden, which is, you know, it's beneficial to the whole community.
So you're a ring-in?
Yeah, part-timer. Part-time community gardener, yeah.
What about you fellas? Do you get some satisfaction out of coming along and being part of a team?
Oh yeah, that's the nice part about the whole project. You've actually got the community working together and the whole diversity and different capabilities and knowledge all being shared. So it's very rewarding on that level.
And does it always go to plan?
Oh no! We have to be very creative on our feet.
And Rob, what do you gain out of this?
My wife and I just recently moved up here. It's a great way to meet like-minded members of the community and to add something to the community as well. Working for money is not as much fun as working on something like this.
You often hear people lamenting the fact that city kids don't know where their food comes from. Well, not this lot from the Arbura Street Primary School in Hobart. These Tassie kids are very switched on when it comes to their food and how it's grown.
My name's Adelaide and I'm 7.
And do you know where eggs come from?
Yes.
Where?
Chickens.
Hello, I'm Alex Blucher. Surrounded by broad beans and cabbages and some very cute kids dressed in cow and bee suits in the school veggie patch. We've gathered here today to take part in a national education program called Kids Teaching Kids, a scheme that involves the students themselves teaching each other about environmental issues such as energy conservation, water, food and waste. Let's go and meet some of them.
My name's Angus and I'm 11 years old.
Can you tell me where milk comes from?
Milk comes from the cow's udder after it's chewed grass and then after a long process in its stomach, it's been put into milk.
James, and I'm 11. I'm planting broad beans because it's sustainable and you can plant the seeds of the broad beans again once they've reproduced.
Why do you think it's important to know where your food comes from?
It's important because they might put chemicals on it and stuff.
I'm Matilda and I'm 11.
Why do you think it's important to be able to use vegetables that you've grown yourself in cooking?
Well, it's very sustainable and you don't have the packaging from imported and processed foods and you learn how to cook your own food.
I'm Rachel Chilcott and I'm helping children who are doing farm to plate demonstrations. They're showing other children how to grow broad bean seeds.
We're sitting in the veggie patch here. There's broad beans right in front of us. What's the ethos behind this Kids Teaching Kids event?
I think it's really about empowering children to learn things that they might not ordinarily do and to give them tools to teach other children the information that they've learned and to learn more about the environment, more about where their food comes from, and more about how it all links together. What they're doing is they're showing the other children how deep to plant the seeds. They're showing them how to put soil in, putting a name tag on, giving them water and describing the process of, you know, a seed germinating and what you need to do to keep them alive. We've got some of the produce from the veggie patch being cooked in the canteen by canteen manager and some of the students and some parents. We've got other displays on human body and how our body needs milk, and we've got displays on milk. We've sort of trying to link in growing food, cooking food, learning about where it all comes from, learning about how it affects our bodies and sustainability. It's become very much an industrial society and we don't often have the opportunity to do this in everyday life.
Leah Bradford, Events and Education Officer at Kids Teaching Kids. The Alborough Street Primary School have all come together today to present workshops to each other. They're all using the Kids Teaching Kids educational model, and that's about making kids the teachers of today. So they've taken all their environmental issues and they're becoming the teachers and teaching other kids.
Why is that important?
Well, we really do believe that this generation are our future environmental leaders, and we do believe kids have a voice, and this way they get the opportunity to use that voice and then inspire other people.
What is Kids Teaching Kids?
It's an educational model, and it really is basically, as it says, kids teaching kids. So kids get to find a topic of interest to them, and then they get to research it. So we kind of say Kids Teaching Kids uses the head, heart and hand. So the head go and think about it, the heart become really passionate about it, and then the hand go and actually action it. And that's what we're seeing today. We're seeing workshops, we're seeing the passion, and then we're seeing the actions come from that.
My name's Adelaide and I'm 7.
And today you're dressed as a bee. Why is that?
Because we're learning about bees.
What do bees make?
Honey.
And do you know how that happens?
Well, the bees go and get pollen and nectar from a flower, and then they bring it back and they put their saliva and the pollen and nectar in a honey cap, and then they mix it all together and make honey.
I didn't even know that. You're very smart. And we have another bee here. What's your name?
Fergus.
How old are you, Fergus?
7.
Do you like eating honey?
Yes.
How do you like eating it?
On bread.
With lots of butter?
Yes.
Yes, that's right, with lots of butter. Young Fergus knows how to eat his bread and honey, thanks to Alex Blucher for that report. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, radio hopefuls head off to school and we find out how an invasive weed has become a gourmet product.
Diving for Undaria, which is an introduced plant that's coming through ballast water. We process that into wakame and mekabu.
And in layman's terms, it's seaweed.
Seaweed. Yep, beautiful seaweed.
It's certainly not a job for the faint-hearted. Pulling on a wetsuit and diving for seaweed in the middle of a Tasmanian winter. But it's all in a day's work for James Ashmore and his partner Craig Sanderson, who are developing a very specialised edible seaweed business here in Hobart. They already have interest from local chefs and restaurants, and even have plans to export their seaweed products back to Japan. Hello, I'm Tony Briscoe. While the products might be new, Craig's interest in seaweed goes back several decades.
Well, I've been associated with seaweed for the last 20 years. I came down here from Melbourne to do a degree here, and I saw then that if you're going to start an industry anywhere in Australia, Tasmania would be the place to be. We believe that wakame was introduced to Tasmania through the Palace Waters probably, and it takes up the whole of the east coast, and it's also the third largest crop in Japan, edible crop. And it's an invasive weed. It's one we want to get rid of. So we've seen this as an opportunity to get into the seaweed market, if you like.
James, what's it like to go diving for seaweed?
Oh, it's great. It doesn't go very fast, so I can catch it. It's good. It's not a deep. It doesn't occur in deep water, so it's quite shallow. And, it's just a great spot to be in the water.
And what about the permits?
Now, we've worked quite closely with the state government on that and with fisheries, and we've got permits to harvest. And it's quite well regulated and it's well managed. It's an invasive species, so there's quite a bit of protocol on how we handle the weed during harvest and post-harvest, so we don't spread. It is deemed as a pest.
So how do you handle it? I mean, how do you go about getting that seaweed from the water into the boat?
Well, we swim around with a large catch bag, a mesh catch bag and a knife, and I just trim the plants just above the holdfast and trim off any surplus inferior plant. So we sort of do a light grade under there. Then we bag the whole plant, which has got the mekabu, which is the spores, and the leaf, which is the wakami. We bag the whole lot, bring it up straight into the boat. Part of the handling is we don't release any surplus water or bilge water while anywhere near outside of the areas, or we do it well and truly inland, so we can't do any spreading of the plant. So it's widespread, but it's quite isolated, and being an annual, it only occurs for a certain amount of months during the year, and then it dies back completely. So in the middle of summer, you won't see it or any trace of it. And right now, it's starting to really come into full size.
We're standing here in the drying room, and it's pretty ugly looking seaweed, and pretty flimsy looking seaweed, I might add, hanging up there. What's the process when you get the seaweed back here to the processing plant?
Okay, well, when we bring it in, we grade it. We lay the plants on a sorting table and grade the product, and then we blanch it. We will separate the mekabu from the main part of the leaf, and we'll blanch it into a commercial brat pan. After that, and when it goes in light brown or dark brown. It comes out brilliant green, which is also acts as a cleansing process of the product. And then we'll separate the products, and we'll do it in a fresh frozen form, or we'll dry it, or we'll salt it. So the drying, we just basically have hung it up, and we've got it in a solar passive room here with a bit of air circulation, and that'll take about 3 or 4 days to dry in a batch. So on the rack there would have been 30 kilo, I believe, 30 kilo of wet weed, and we'll recover three and a half kilo. So quite a lot of water loss. There's not much retention, but when it rehydrates brilliantly, absolutely brilliantly, it comes back and it retains its texture, and is more workable for some of the chefs.
Talking about the end product, Craig, what are the chefs using it for? What sort of recipes?
Well, there's quite a variety of uses for wakami. The best known of the recipes is for a soup, miso soup. And that's very common in Japan and in the Asian countries, and it's becoming more popular here. Other unique ones that we've found is a toasted product that you can put under the toaster with a few sesame seeds on the top, and that gives a nice crisp. But we're learning all the time. Seaweed salad's another very popular one. They add it with a few other different coloured seaweeds for appearance sake. So it's, and it's a learning process for us too, Tony.
And James, what do you tell people you do when you say you're going out diving? What do you tell them you're diving for?
Oh, I don't know. It's funny when you get back to the boat ramp and they say, "Did you get much, mate?" And you're going, yeah, a bit of weed." Their eyes light up. No, it's all good. It's all good fun. Some of those recipes and some of those chefs, it's quite interesting what Craig was saying. I think that's a really interesting part of this, is that it's a sustainable product. It's pest elimination. And it really is, it's quite trendy at the moment. And some of the recipes these guys are coming up with in restaurants in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and Hobart, you know, the local places around here, are doing some amazing things with this stuff. And the wakami, once it's been blanched and or dried and then rehydrated, is just like a vegetable. And when you hold it, you treat it like you would a spinach. And it's just open up, stir frying, anything. It's just amazing.
So what about exporting to Japan?
Yep, well, we've had some interest there, and we're going through the processes now, and we've sent some samples away. There's interest there, so we're investigating every opportunity.
I'm still carrying the bruises from the last cagey bull I rode.
Getting the nerve to jump on the back of a 1.5-ton bull with a bad attitude is not something many people would do in their spare time. But for those with the inclination, bull riding can be an adrenaline-pumping career. And there's even a school where you can learn some of the tricks of the trade. Hello, I'm Amy McCosker in Rockhampton in central Queensland. It's here that famous American bull rider Gary LeFou and his bullfighting mate Rob Smets are holding a two-day training school for would-be rodeo champions. I knew I'd be watching in class in action, but I'd never dreamt I would be becoming one of the students being hoisted high on a training barrel.
With a little bit of luck, I'll win a few bucks today chasing rodeo.
Now we get on.
Please,
no, I'm not going to drop you. You're good.
Slide up a little farther up here. Now, when he goes up, I want you to take your belly button and put it out towards here. Take it up, just like riding a jumping horse. It's like a dance. You got to relax. You're a little tense. So you got to relax.
Yeah. I'm tense up in the air. So.
So now you know what it feels like to ride a nice easy bull.
After just a short stint on the training barrel, I gave up any thought of a future rodeo career and concentrated on the job at hand, watching young teenagers learning from these industry legends. Gary says that to get students ready to ride a bull, they need to start small.
You know, in actuality, the best thing to cross-train on is a horse bareback. You know, it's real similar to riding a jumping horse. The same motion that you're going to do on that horse, you're going to do on that bull. So this is probably, before you get on the horse, you get on this and kind of get the motion down. And then you get on the horse and you start lunging them in and out of a gully, you know, as you with no hands. When you come up out of the gully, if you sit down, you slide off and fall off. So you get back on and you keep playing with it till you get the timing down. And then you start to go over jumps, you know. And once you get the jumps down, then you're ready to start on bulls, you know. And you start on, you see some of these are out here, are Holsteins or what they call Frisians over here. They're real easy, you know, so... once you get them down, you move up to another level. And once you get them down, you move to another level. So it's just a level at a time where you build confidence as you go.
While Gary made his name on the back of a bull, Rob spent more time on the ground. His career as a bull fighter has seen many broken bones and close calls. He's training the students to be quick on their feet.
Your job is, when the cowboy comes off, to make sure you provide yourself as a better target for the bull than what the cowboy is. Hopefully he rides in and walks out safely, and hopefully I walk in and walk out safely too. There's good nights at the office and there's bad nights. There's nights that you get run over, and you know, that's what you're getting paid for.
So what are the skills, if you could break it down right down to the bottom level, what are the skills that you're teaching them, the drills that you go through?
Well, a lot of the drills that I'll go through is trying to get first to get them to relax. You know, and that we need to realize that it's always better to go slow and to gain speed. The best thing to fight bulls, you need to stay square. Whenever my feet are crossed over, for me, by the time I turn all the way back around to get there, the bull has changed leads. A bull moves like a horse does on a lead. So we give them the basic set of fundamentals. As you said, about riding on the dummy or fighting the bulls, we can only mark so many X's and O's on the chalkboard out here. And then you got to get in there and nod your head.
After 2 days of training, the students are encouraged to go home and practice their drills again and again and again. But even after all the practice, both Gary and Rob agree that mastering the moves is only part of being a good bull rider. And that's why relaxation and meditation are also a part of the course.
There's a process of what we call clearing your head, where you clear your head of all conscious thought. Zen masters say when you clear your head of all conscious thought, you access the experience of 10,000 lifetimes. There's nothing you don't already know how to do. So it's amazing once you clear your head and are able to just react and be in what they call in Zen is in the moment. You know, when I got into positive thinking and relaxation, I was 6 months without staying on a single bull. I did that for 2 months, and the first bull I got on after that, I was 1 point off the all-time record. It's 3 months before they throwed me off, and I went to runner-up for the world's championship that year behind the guy that I was role modeling. So it's huge, and using bulls as a metaphor for life.
And another point that Gary and Rob agree on is which part of the sport is tougher.
Oh, the bullfighters by far. yeah, they take a beating. I rode for 20 years, and I can't even remember getting hooked. You know, as I rode good and I got off, and here's the guy stepped in, take the hook, and if so, hooking is going to be taken. So,
you know, because our job, we're very proud of it. It's always said it's a lot like being the bodyguard for our president, the Secret Service guys. And I fought bulls for 30 years. I survived 3 broken necks, 1 goring and 1 broken leg over a, you know, 30-year career. It's a badge of honor to us, you know. If somebody's going to get hurt, not on my watch.
It's the only life I know. Sometimes you only get one go, but that's life chasing rodeo. Yeah, that's life chasing rodeo.
Bullfighter Rob Smets and bull rider Gary LeFou from the United States passing on some rodeo skills to Amy McCosker in Rockhampton. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. My name's Libby Price. Next, both kinds of country. How country councils need to plan for the tree changer invasion.